Well, let's do some of you. We were talking about the red one.
Very nice.
As opposed to my union slip.
You guys are so fun to listen to on tape. All your comments.
Oh, this is Jane. I think Jane already got one. He made two for you, Jane.
Oh. They make two for you?
Mm-hmm. I'm a Gemini.
Oh.
She knew why.
One part of the brain goes one place and the other.
In a way, we're just repeating from the point of view of different imagery what we did in part one, so far anyway. And as I said, I'm about two pages ahead of you. I've read the whole thing once, but, you know, unless you really concentrate on it, I don't remember so much. I think the big one-liner that helps us understand why the red one appears is... second column on 259, you're no real pagan, but the kind of pagan who runs alongside our Christian religion. So it'd be that aspect of the psyche that Christianity has, and I think Jung would say, had to exclude, because when it was born, when Christianity was born, that side was so out of control. But that's remained the shadow. I think he says the kind of pagans. I think he would say paganism isn't necessarily destructive. The pre-scientific tribes are often very peaceful. But what it's become is something that compensates or stands in a compensatory relationship to the idealism of Christianity. And that's pretty much what we did last time. Oh, the other thing maybe he said there is on 260, this first column halfway down. He whose heart has not been broken over, the Lord Jesus Christ, drags a pagan around in himself, who holds him back from the best. And I think by that he means the archetype of crucifixion. That the problem with Christianity is it honors the crucifix, but then people feel they are spared from going through their own crucifixion. And part of maturing is the death of the ego and the birth of the self, which is a crucifixion.
So then that allows other religious points of view, if you look at it that way, not just Christianity.
Right. Exactly. I don't know if Jung was intending it, but... certainly, the net effect was, one of the net effects is I think he really paves the way for an ecumenical religious viewpoint, because he's looking at these themes. Doesn't matter whether Christianity picks them up, or Islam picks them up, or Buddhism picks them up, and he doesn't want to get locked into one cultural manifestation of these forms. That takes us to 260. Maybe one more thing. We'll start up in the middle of 260. There is a joy, et cetera, et cetera. But notice how the red man transforms into green right before that. And that would be parallel to what we saw in the transformation of Salome. And
I thought it was Jung himself that...
oh, yes, it is. It is, it is, it is. Sorry, you're right.
The red man gets fleshy.
You're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right, you're right. Yes, indeed. My green garments everywhere burst into leaf. So again, I think it's the parallel transformation to Salome and Elijah. And we're not done with it. We'll keep circling around this theme from many points of view.
So why do you think he goes after Judaism? Some of this you can relate almost all of this to him,
mm-hmm.
and the world.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think this part relates to him also personally?
You mean I must come to the Jews' defense? You seem to be a Jew hater. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, the where he says the Jews lack something.
Yeah.
Do you think that was something also in his feeling?
That's really complicated. It's touchy to talk about. But interestingly, I just got a book on Chinese history. And in the beginning, the guy makes the comment, China, the Chinese, is the only culture that has stayed in national tact since its inception. Sumerians came and went, the Babylonians came and went, the Egyptians came and went, and so on. Now, he doesn't say anything about the Jews in that book. But I think that's what Jung is driving at, because the Jews would say, well, but we have stayed intact. But he would say, not as a nation. And that has caused particular problems. I think that is the best of why he is questioning this Jewish psychology, because it has a particular effect on the psyche, I think you would say.
And what would that be? Defensiveness.
I'm not sure. Maybe defensiveness.
Because they weren't allowed to stay in
that. Right. Because they don't have, or up to now, certainly at this point, didn't have a continuous national heritage. That's my guess. I don't think he's ever said that. But that's my guess. Sandy?
Did they always have kind of like two different, they have a very conservative Jews, the Hasidic Jews, and then they have the other more progressive Jews. So those are two different factions. That's, you said something about them being all one. Maybe I missed
it. Well, no, he's just looking at the fact that Judaism has existed without a country.
Right. Okay.
And what has been the effect of that on the Jewish psyche. Okay. I think that's been the motivation for his comments, in my guess.
Okay. Well, if they didn't have a country, if they didn't feel like they had a home.
Right.
If you always were displaced.
Right.
They call them displaced.
Right.
Then I guess that filter, I mean, that you would always feel like you're having to defend.
Yeah.
Your right to exist.
Yeah. And I think Jung made comments like this around the rise of the Nazis to power. That's what pissed so many people off. And, you know, he apologized for saying that. He realized it was a mistake. And, interestingly, the biggest Jewish scholars were his house guests. So as far as they were concerned, it was resolved. It's the rest of the people who don't think it's resolved. And I would just present both sides. One, what he said was very bad timing. Second, is it untrue? This is the problem. You can't get to that discussion because of when it was said. And additionally, he has said nasty things about Americans. He said nasty things about Swiss. He has said nasty things about Germans, nasty things about the English, about the Chinese. When he speaks about Jews, then he's anti-Semitic. That is what he is, what's going on in him, I think. That you really have to be so careful about what you say about Jewish psychology, or you can tear down anybody else, and then we'll say, oh, yeah, we are assholes.
It's interesting that it comes up now. It sort of makes me feel as though it's not personal. It's what's coming up in society.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, I would never discuss this in public, believe me, but I have plenty of Jewish friends who are disgusted with Israel and are appalled at what's going on. So, in a way, these issues have not resolved. It is still a very current issue. And who knows, you know, if some Palestinian gets a hold of a dirty bomb, the whole world could blow up over there. Yet we can't really talk about it. Because then we're anti-Semitic. I mean, that's that's another side of the argument.
Aren't we allowed, I mean, it seems like it would be part of our shadow that some, we all have some prejudices, and some of us are more willing to admit them than others,
yeah.
But it is possible that as a Christian of that time in Europe, he might have had some negative feelings about Jews as a whole, and, you know, if we can accept that he was unfaithful to his wife,
I don't buy he was unfaithful to his wife.
Well, I know, but I know we've had that discussion, but if we can accept his other faults, but we get very upset if he says something that confronts us in our culture. I mean, you know, I wouldn't probably say this in public, but I cannot say that I am free from prejudice against Middle Eastern people. They scare me, and I catch myself all the time saying things to my kids that I wish I could put right back in my mouth because I realize that, and 100 years from now, the things that I say will probably be revolting to say my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, mm-hmm. but it is appropriate for this time that we're in now, and where he was in Europe at that time, there was a lot of anti-Semitism. I mean, I don't understand why it's not okay for him to have possibly had some prejudices against
him. Well, that's the whole point. That is exactly the point. I don't think he did. But remember, he just split from Freud. And psychoanalysis was a Jewish movement. And he was accused of being a Gentile who didn't play by their rules. So that's a factor in there, too. Mm-hmm.
In his biography, the Deeper Bear, which I don't think of, but there was a lot devoted, not a lot, but there was a chapter devoted to the fact that he was trying to save the Jewish people,
right.
And analysts or the psychologists who were Jewish in the, what's the name? Okay. The Analytical Psychology Club of Berlin, and the one in Austria too. So I mean, he went to quite a length to an energy he used to work with a lawyer to write up papers to get these people out of Germany and into Switzerland. So by that account, it turned him. And it just hit me. He might have known this thing. And Freud was Jewish, right?
Oh yeah. See, all of psychoanalysis was Jewish.
So he might have seen an aspect of Freud and the others, and is commenting on what he saw there too.
I think he is.
But he did work a lot. He worked really hard because he could see the danger they were in.
Yeah.
And he tried to get them out of there.
Well, since we're onto it, let's get the whole story. There are two things that he's been accused of. One, which I mentioned, these statements, I forget exactly what they were, but something on the order of, you know, the Jewish culture has never stood on its own, meaning it's never had a nation. Of course, that just pissed everybody off.
And there was also that comment about there were too many Jewish people in the intellectual field.
Did he say that?
And,
I'm not aware of that. You sure he said that?
Well, I had it. It was quoted from a text from a private letter in that International Indian Studies group. So
I don't know
I guess
about
we
that.
Can take it with a grain of salt.
I don't know. Anyway, he made comments that can be twisted. I say twisted because you put the word Chinese in there, it wouldn't bother you. But you put the word Jewish in there, people get upset. I think that's... There are two sides to the coin. It was wrong, and yet, if you think about it in a larger context, it wasn't wrong. The other thing which Jane was referring to, and this is just, I think, totally bogus, these accusations. He was president of the International Association for Psychoanalysis. I don't know if that's the exact name, but it was centered in Nazi Germany. And he stayed president as a Swiss. to give it an international flavor. And he did so as a Swiss, because Switzerland was neutral. And because he did that, he's been accused of being a Nazi sympathizer, which is just ridiculous. It's just, I think behind all of this is the sickness that doesn't want to hear what Jung is saying. And so they're looking for reasons to trash him. And that, I'm willing to say, Jung, you made a bad statement. He said, I'm sorry, I said it. It was wrong timing. He never said it was wrong. He said it was wrong timing. Bad timing with a destructive, it could be used against the Jews. And he said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. I didn't think of that. But the other one, this president of the International Association, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, he had a lawyer there. They're writing up papers and trying to get them out of there.
Yeah, and eventually, I think they published a magazine. See, it was an international association, as it is with our group. There's an international association, and then there are satellite associations all around the world. I belong to one in Zurich, and I belong to one in Ohio. The German satellite of the International Association then put his name as president of their group on a newsletter. He immediately resigned. That was done without his knowledge. So people were showing, look at this, you see, here's the German newsletter published in Germany, and Goering's brother, I think, was on the staff. It's true slander. But just, you might want to know that if you ever come up against these arguments.
But Gary, what you were saying is people that don't want to hear what he's saying, isn't that the part above there where it says about the crucifixion? I mean, if you don't want to be crucified yourself, you go out and crucify somebody. That's the projection.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right. Some of you watched this. I got a copy if you want to borrow it. Gerhard Adler, who's a Jew, reacts in an interview to this situation. If you ever want to hear how a Jew responded to it. And he does so very sensitive. He said, we were very upset. It was a very bad timing. We went to Jung, and he apologized. No, he's saying, Jesus, if all the dumb things I ever said got into print, I'd be in big trouble. So, there you have it. Okay, so we're talking about the red man. And let's say basically he's about pleasure again. Jung is wrestling with pleasure. Again, to put it in historical context, remember, what is Freud's primary motivating drive? The pleasure principle. And I think Jung had heard from Freud the importance, and I agree, of, you might say, if it feels good, do it. Because so much of our life is based on not living what we... I did it again. System is on. No, on virtual memory, sorry. So much of our life is based on not doing what we really want to, and then constructing all sorts of defensive things around it, like projection, like blaming, like denial, and somebody else has to pay the price. And so Jung realizes, there's something to this, but it's also got some problems with it. So I think that's what he's working out here to a large extent. He's realizing we have to accept the desire for pleasure and read Tony Wolfe in there, because that's the big opportunity for pleasure he had. On the one hand, and on the other hand, the terrific dangers, the hurt, the problems that are caused by this, as well as the wisdom that can come to you through it. And the purpose of these chapters is, as I get it, at least at the moment, how do you do that? How do you not live moralistically? and not destroy your life on the one hand, and on the other hand, grow through it. That is the foundation of Jungian psychology. In a way, it's very close to Freud. Libido. With Freud, it was libido. And Jung is just saying it is a heck of a lot more complicated than simply following the pleasure principle. And that's what he's trying to get straight. Remember, he doesn't understand the answer to this yet. So he's really talking to himself. So we pick up middle of 260. A second column. The red, I, he says, perhaps too there is a joy before God that one can call dancing, but I haven't yet found this joy. I look out for things that are yet to come. Things came, but joy was not among them. The red man says, don't you recognize me, brother? I am joy. He says, could you be joy? I see you as through a cloud. Your image fades. Let me take your hand, beloved. Who are you? Who are you? Joy, was he joy? Well, as I said, I think what we'll do is we'll go through the active imaginations sentence by sentence, and then we have an active imagination followed by a commentary, which we don't have to go through quite as carefully. So his commentary starts then on just what he's done by that number two. And he says in the second line, joy, this joy is the joy of the serious person. Jung, I think we can agree, was a serious person. In a way, taking the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's realizing the importance of joy, which I'm thinking at this point he didn't have a whole lot of in his life. And he also realizes, look, about maybe two-thirds of the way down that paragraph, whoever tastes this joy, see where I am? Whoever tastes this joy forgets himself. And there is nothing sweeter than forgetting himself. Problem is, you also forget the consequences of what you're doing. I mean, think of the politicians who find some young babe, and there goes everything they've ever worked for. That's exactly what he's dealing with.
History is a talk show.
And in this culture, you end up doing pretty well, because we have had so much of the seriousness that we have overvaluated the importance of the red one.
I had a question.
Yeah.
The high tower, who keeps watch alone on the high tower. Is that his Christian...
Where is that, Cindy?
Sure, the third line down. Surely this red one, number two?
Yeah. that was my joy, the joy of the serious person who keeps watch alone on the high tower.
The high tower felt like that, well, Christians, okay, I'll take it from a Catholic experience, Catholics think they are the ones.
Yeah.
And that would be a high tower to me. That would be that. So I wondered if that had to do with Christianity. I don't know about Christ.
Yeah, I think it's, if I got it right, it's any moral position that thinks it's above the temptation of the passions. And, you know, if you just listen to the fundamentalists, they're sure they have, you know, all this sin is below them. They'll never fall for that. And if you would just be as righteous as I am, you would be above it too. And then, boom, they fall right into it. Yeah, I think that's, and I think Jung then would have been in that position.
He's feeling very conflicted at the moment. I'm sensing that.
Yeah, sure, because he's on one side he is moral, and on the, and and bored. On the other hand, he's full of desire, and he knows it's going to cause harm. Either way, he loses.
Do you remember the image, though, of him in the high tower at the very beginning? I don't know how to remember that one. He's in the green, it might be at the very beginning. The first image.
Yeah.
Where he's in the high tower.
Shall I go back?
Yes, it's that one. Yeah.
Hang on, the darn computer is...
Okay.
Can you see it okay, or do we need to kill a light?
Yeah, please. And he even says at the beginning there, as he's, you know, looking out, I know nothing about a way, therefore I can neither be this nor that. So he is conflicted.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know, but he's looking for something. He's looking for something there, and he sees the red one coming.
Good point. He never takes the one on his budget.
That's right. And that's joy.
That's good. Yeah. I hadn't remembered that, but oops.
But that could be represent his position, like Sandy said, his time, moral position at the time.
I wonder if that's why it's the red platform. Or he's looking for a way through this without avoiding the realities, the consequences of the other one.
Yeah, because remember right above, he says, it is conceivable that there is some third thing for which dancing would be the symbol.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So dancing would be between that elevated position and the red one. And what we're going to see is, his solution is, you have to go into the pleasure. Mm-hmm. There is no salvation through morality. There's only salvation through joy. You see, this is completely opposite the church. He doesn't give up salvation, but he says we've got to find it a different way. And you go through the desire consciously. That's the difference.
Wasn't the name of one of your presentations about how we're dancing between heaven and earth? And it's similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven would be that high moral position. Earth would be just falling into the pleasure principle.
Yeah.
And he's trying to dance between those two things.
Now, I think, you know, apropos your comment, Danny, when a lot of people say, oh, he was unfaithful. If he hadn't been up there, I'd agree with you. But he knew and could live a moral life, but he realized it had reached a dead end. So, if you speak this today, you say to somebody who's not got a piece of them that's up in a moral place, well, they just use it as an excuse to be a jerk.
Right.
That's what's so dangerous about it. And it could be another reason why he's not accepted, because the world knows, I mean, I think fewer and fewer people are up on that position. Anyone I've talked to in business has said, I've seen things just go to the dogs in the last 10 years. Everything we do is corrupt. So that is something to remember, that you're dealing with a guy who could be moral but was facing the choice of giving up that morality for joy, trying to get back to some moral position that wasn't repressive of the pleasure of life. And I think he solved it, as we'll see. Well, we've seen it already. He becomes green. Salome could see, and Elijah transforms. But this is what he confronted in himself, without any guide. And we'll see more of that.
And didn't he say a few chapters back something about, maybe that's in Zarathustra, where he talked about
being a philosopher and what that assault, but that isn't Zarathustra.
Well, we come to it too, the boring old scholars.
Yes, but he talks about knowing what you stand for and living it, and that's being a philosopher.
Right.
Live instead of just talking. Just a lot of words like Nietzsche was saying, just a lot of bombastic things, and putting himself up there in that high tower.
See, he's getting pretty close to Freddy there.
Yeah, but Jung was trying to live both things in himself. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Yeah, and to live it, to come out with a philosophy in the original Greek sense of a workable view of life's meaning, not independent of ethics. Well, I think right along the line of what you were saying, the next paragraph, second line, this I learned in the Mysterium. Mysterium was when he met Salome and Elijah, remember. To take seriously every unknown wanderer who personally inhabits the inner world, meaning he has to take the red, I keep saying night, the red night seriously.
But in the Grail, the red night is Parsifal's future self. So there's something with the red one, I think, that is part of Jung's future.
Oh.
He holds a future seed for him.
The seed, you don't get it here yet, but this is one of these things that... maybe he's even offensive, I don't know. But the self is in the shadow at first. In other words, the self comes to you through your having followed your desire, your joy. Now, maybe that joy will work out, maybe it won't, but the only way, as far as Jung is working anyway, the only way to that self is through that joy.
Because Parsifal kills the Red Knight just because he desires his horse and his clothing and his arms. He doesn't really know what it means to be a knight, and that's his future, is to become a different kind of knight. And Jung's future is to become a different kind of individual, would you say?
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't kill the red one. He interacts with it. So that shows to me, I'm just kind of looking at the Grail as we...
Yeah, absolutely.
It shows his consciousness has developed quite a bit more than Percival was doing.
Grail is the medieval solution. Mm-hmm. Jung's is the modern solution. Why couldn't Parsifal not kill the knight because he wasn't strong enough? If he had accepted his joy, he would have gone off and become a producer of porn flicks or something. Yeah.
What I think was interesting about that he stole everything from the Red Knight, and it sort of reminds me of now when people take all the trappings that their money can bring them, but that's still all they've got.
Yeah, exactly.
Clothes. And
yeah. And, you know, what's funny about those people, listen to them, they're probably hedonistic as hell, and moralistic.
And what?
Moralistic.
Moralistic, yeah.
Full of criticism of other people's errant ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Nightly news. So how does this play out? Well, he's working on this very hard in his real life. He knows that it's going to cause pain for people that he cares about. What does that look like when it plays out? I mean, it's one thing to be in your room alone having these
active imaginations and really struggling to work it through. But it's another thing to wake up in the morning and look in your wife's eyes. And I do understand what you're saying. I mean, the one thing I give him a lot of credit for is he was very honest about it. And I think that took tremendous courage. But how does that play out? I mean, how do you get through the day if you're a moral person? You know that you're causing pain, and you're really trying to work it out. You're still causing the pain. So, you know, where does personal responsibility come in, and how do you manage that responsibility in the real world?
Well, I think the answer to that is on a couple of levels. One, alchemy is the solution. Namely, if you are going to do this and you have an established capacity to be moral, two big ifs, and you follow your desire while watching your dreams, the idea is that in time, the dreams will begin showing you who you are in a way they wouldn't do if you didn't do that. Okay. So you get images of yourself and your duties to your development, your duties to the world out of this experience. And what I've seen is when that happens, the desire goes away. Yeah.
Just from a day-to-day standpoint, it seems like righteousness or something like that is different than moral, being moralistic. I mean, self-righteous arrogance.
Right.
Versus being a truly moralistic person.
Or a moral person.
A moral person. But it seems to me that the way he got through it with Emma was to be in constant relationship and working through. And now, you know, working through that day-to-day grind, but it's also, I mean, there's good things that come up. But to work that every day and being in relationship, which our culture doesn't really value, but that gets him through with her and for her. And I don't know if that...
Yeah, well, there's a practical dimension to your question, too, Tammy, which I didn't answer, and you've touched on. How do you pull off practically? Well, you got to be honest. And you got to say, I don't know exactly what they converse, but I would imagine something like, this is what I'm going to do. If you want a divorce, I'll grant you a divorce. If you want to go through it with me, then we're going to go through it together. And she must have decided we're going to go through it together. On the other hand, I was surprised to learn, I just finished taking a class in 18th century literature at Butler with a French teacher. What percentage of 18th century women, married women, do you think had lovers? This is 1700s.
Had lovers in France?
Yeah, had permanent lovers. Okay. Had a husband and a lover.
Probably 80%. I don't know.
75%.
Get out.
No. All the literature we read is about this issue. What is fidelity? What is passion? What are the complications that come? They were dealing with this in the 18th century. So this is not as strange to them as it would be to us. But still, I think it's got to be done with discussion. And Jung was prepared to commit suicide. He said, I was swimming out in the lake, and I thought, why don't I just drown right here and save Emma and Tony a lot of pain? But I think both of them knew something was being born. And I don't think most people have to go through this. Some people have to go through this. And then Jung's work is valuable when they do.
He must have been able to let her know every day that he loved her, Emma, so much, in spite or in addition to, but she felt it was real. She felt it was genuine. But to do that day in and day out and be able to.
Yeah, and they had dinner. They had her over for Sunday dinner.
That would have been hard.
Yeah.
Very hard.
Yeah. Well, but they were in the Nietzsche readings. Oftentimes, Emma's asking questions and shows Tony.
Yeah.
So you
know
they're there.
It was a hothouse. Yeah. I think any creation of value is paid for. One way or the other. I don't think you can show one person's life who's made a major contribution to culture who hasn't had a very difficult love life.
Usually they're not conscious. Usually they're cats.
Usually they're jerks. And maybe that's what gives this stuff such a bad name. Mm-hmm. That he was having an affair. Well, he was. He had two wives. And they agreed to it. That's how I understand it. So joy.
So, you know, if Emma had found someone,
so we don't know if she found anybody or not.
But, you know, he always said there's four things operating, you know,
mm-hmm.
your conscious, yourself, your ego, your shadow, your animus, and those four things. I mean, so when you're talking to somebody, you're really talking to four things, four people. And I was thinking, well, if Emma had found someone that she wanted to go through that with, like really living it.
Well, we don't know whether she did or not. That's.
Or she might.
And I doubt whether they would tell you if they knew. Oh, we have no idea what she was doing. Well,
yeah.
Of course, she probably had help.
Yeah, she did.
So who knows? But yeah, it was difficult. I do not underestimate the difficulty. And what he's dealing with here is dialogue within himself that precedes living his pleasure.
Yeah, and when did he have time for Tony or Emma when he was doing all of this? I mean, this would take hours and hours.
Mm-hmm. And a full practice, and, well, let's see what year is it. No, I haven't done any seminars yet, but, yeah.
And kids.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably heard me say it. I'll just say it anyway again. That a friend of mine is friends with Jung's last surviving daughter, Lil. Must be in her 90s. And she still does workshops up in the Alps on Russian iconography. And she said, the worst thing about getting old is that I've run out of energy arguing with the son of a bitch, is her word, that are intent on pulling down my dad. I just run out of energy fighting with him. And he was a wonderful dad. So there, that's from the horse's mouth. So we're back to the devil. Joy, devil. You can equate the two for the moment. Why do we equate joy and the devil? Well, we'll see. Four lines down. Because religion is precisely what the devil and I cannot agree about. I must have it out with him, as I cannot expect that he, as an independent personality, would accept my standpoint without further ado. So he realizes his religious values and his, let's say, his shadow for the moment, are at odds. And part of what he's going to be going through is discovering the religious meaning of desire. The religious meaning of that red one who now says there's no such thing as God. And, he says, a very similar thing in the next paragraph, a second line, if you ever have the rare opportunity to speak with the devil, then do not forget to confront him in all seriousness. Seriousness would be, I'm accepting your pleasure, devil, but I'm not accepting it in a cavalier way. And then, next paragraph, taking the devil seriously does not mean going over to his side, or else one becomes the devil. That would be the playboy, you know, the libertine who just follows pleasure. Rather, it means coming to an understanding. And then the third line in the next paragraph, through religion, the devil can be brought to an understanding. And I understand that to mean that within, if you live these pleasure experiences consciously, generally they're very complicated, and in the frustration of those complications, you get dream images which point to the self. So that the desire is teleological. Does that make sense if I put it that way? That he hasn't quite realized that desire is teleological. But what he's going to come to is desire is teleological.
That's interesting, but the very next sentence is about dancing.
Yeah, go ahead, Jane.
You want to
read that?
What I said about dancing struck him because I spoke about something that belonged to his own domain. I just
hadn't thought about
dancing belonging to anybody's, the devil's domain.
Yeah, well, it's pleasure.
But it's between.
It goes up and down.
Between the pleasure and, like we were saying before, it's that thing in between.
Mm-hmm.
There's being an arrogant moralist. And then pleasure.
Yep, absolutely.
So it's combining it somehow, but it's
well, combining in a way, I would say more what we're going to is that we have to distill desire.
Distill?
Yeah. You got to start with it. But you have to be cooked until the essence of it comes off. And then that is your new selfhood.
And that's where the alchemy comes
in. And that alchemy is Jung working this problem through to its end. Absolutely. And you've probably heard, some of you heard me say this. Where we see it the most clearly is in Jung's understanding of the erotic feelings that come up in an analytic situation between a man and a woman. Because in my case, a male therapist and a female analyst. And when the meaning of that is understood, they disappear. I mean from 315 to 316. Gone. Boom. You may have thought, well, I'm going to throw my whole career away. She's the one I've been waiting for. And in 30 seconds, it's gone. When the meaning is understood. And these poor bastards that concretize it never get to that point. And generally ruin the analysand and their own careers. Because it feels like the real thing. And it is real, but at a different level.
At the end of that paragraph, he says that when he and the devil can come to some kind of understanding between them, then the devil humanizes himself before his eyes and he turns green.
See, we are back to that again.
Right. So the act of engaging our own inner devil humanizes them.
Yep.
And when we can come to some kind of agreement or acceptance of that, then we change. Is that right?
We change and it becomes less compulsive.
Okay.
need to concretize it. I mean, he did have the relationship with Tony Moore, which he was able to grow through and come up with him in psychology, but then sometimes it's the absolute wrong. I guess there's not a guideline.
I don't think there is, really. You know, being a child of the 60s, I say to people who aren't married, well, for God's sakes, if you like the person, go sleep with them. If you're married, it's another issue. I would say err on the side of going with for joy, personally, unless you're in a professional or marital situation. And then it becomes something for discussion in analysis and both in the marriage. In analysis, I don't know what... I've never seen anyone concretize it successfully. I'm not saying it's impossible, because really, if you say, you know, God is love, then who am I to judge? But I would say, in all cases, you've got to stop the therapeutic relationship. And I don't know what our code of ethics says anymore. It used to be, I think, a year. Have no personal contact for a year. They may have changed that. I don't know. I know, according to the American Psychological Association, you may never have a sexual relationship with a previous client. That's wrong. See, that puts the state in the place of God. I do know people who have married their analysands. Some pretty prominent unions, and they've been together for 30 years, so who's to say that's wrong? See what I'm saying? It gets really complicated, and the law makes it black and white. That's not right either. But I think generally it's a recipe for disaster. I've seen quite a few women who have slept with their therapists, and every one of them were inaccessible. What happens is the therapist becomes God. In the unconscious, it's a hieros gamos. And anything I say is paltry by comparison. So you really destroy people by doing that. That's the big crime.
The only person I know who ever slept with the therapist gave the devil to her. I mean, she was destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Happens more often than you'd think.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Yeah. We've just led right into the next quote. Yet that joy is the devil. Or that devil is joy has got to worry you. So we're moving toward linking up the joy and the devil. Why? I don't think he wants to say that joy is bad. But joy lived unconsciously usually ends up with a destructive consequence. You see, for every statement I make, I almost have to make another one to qualify it. Joy is good, but... Morality is good, but...
Could we say that the other opposite is... Could you also... use the but there too. God is love, but I mean, you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, could you do it conversely?
I think you could. Yeah. I think you probably have to.
Okay. I was thinking of a different opposite when you said that. You could say joy lived unconsciously is usually destructive, but morality lived unconsciously also destructive.
I would say is always destructive. That's the historical statement. We are at a time where morality has become, or had become, so destructive. I'm talking about 19th century. Had become so destructive that we've swung to the other side, probably of necessity. That makes sense? So in a way, this is a historically conditioned document.
Don't you think that the I Ching gives a nice commentary on this whole idea of joy in the hexagram seductive joyousness?
Go ahead. I don't know if I know that.
Well, it just gives all of the
surrounding complications and joy that he's talking about. You know,
yeah.
It's like a study on
all the complications and the joy.
Complications and the joy. And I had a painting, and I called it initially Seductive Joyousness. Then I changed it to Lake of My Home, which is Nietzsche's term for the personal unconscious or personal devil.
I follow.
I didn't know this then, but mm-hmm. now it makes sense why those two.
Yeah,
together.
But Seductive Joy and Lake of My Home are the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Lake of My Home. Lake of My Home.
Are you in the Nietzsche class?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you remember the part where Nietzsche calls the personal unconscious the lake of my home? One's own personal body of water,
yes.
So to speak. One's own personal unconscious.
And also there's a church called Joy of All Desire at Delaware 16. Mm-hmm. Joy of All Desire. Mm-hmm.
Sound like the same old crap to me. How about the joy of joy? The joy of those who have fun.
Well, if you're talking about joy leading to wisdom, there's joy. There's sorrow in that.
Yeah. What I think they're saying is, if you're sorrowful, you're really joyful.
It's the Blessed
Mother's on the phone. Figures. I don't think she had much joy. Do you think? Can you say, see her sash showing up to a pub and say, give me a margarita?
Can you imagine having to have a kid and never having sex? Just
I was trying to put it as a metaphor.
Actually, I kind of fancy her doing that because she had to be so incredibly bold to go through with it. She had to be so bold that that she had to be really spitfire. And so I would guess that she had a wonderful sense of humor and saw joy in everything. She would have to be open to ecstasy to take that on. But that's maybe my...
Yeah, because what we learn in the Catholic Church is meek and mild.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was the one that asked for more wine at the wedding reception.
Yeah. And there's a sculpture, and I can't remember the artist's name, but it's right after the birth, and it bothered him that it was always, you know, like, oh, we're just sitting nice in this wrapped baby, and, you know, because the fact is that you're sweating and you're bleeding and it's violent and it's loud. And so he did this sculpture where her veil is off and her hair is a tangled wild mess, and she's standing, she has the baby in one hand and her fist pumped in the air in the other, like, yes, you know. And so I thought, oh, that's a wonderful image for her. Yeah.
Mary evolved.
Well, we're back to devil and joy. Last paragraphs on 261. I think we've kind of done it. I think a good summing up sentence is the last sentence on top of 261, that last short paragraph. It is always a risky thing to accept joy. But it leads us to life. That's the positive. And it's disappointment. So the disappointment is the devilish aspect, then, from which the wholeness of our life becomes. So the disappointments, when accepting joy, lead the road to wholeness. Because it's in that disappointment that you begin to withdraw the projection from what you once found as your source of joy. But you have to have the joy before you can withdraw the projection.
Is he really talking about any kind of joy, or is he talking about this big, you know...
I think he's talking about sexual joy.
Okay.
I think. I mean, he doesn't actually say it, but
I wonder, because I see evangelicals all the time. They talk a lot about joy, but they spend a whole lot of time doing everything not to be joyful.
Yeah.
And it's not just sex, it's everything.
Well, whatever your devil is.
Yeah. You might say Dionysian. Whatever is Dionysian for you, it could be, well, I think it could be anything. Mm-hmm. But a passion, a driven passion, gambling, sex, greed, all of this, I think, would count.
Writing a book. Well, over Thanksgiving, I was with my evangelical family, and there's a one-year-old, and she was pushing her cousin's nose, and her cousin would fall over, and she just turned 9. And they were having the best time. I mean, both of them were giggling, and it was like that great kid gut laugh stuff. And the baby's mother was taking video, because just over and over, you know, she thought this was the funniest thing ever. And then she walked over to her husband, and she said, "Look, I've got 5 minutes of mean baby." And I thought, what? Mean baby? How can a baby? She's 1 year old. How can she possibly be mean? But that was a sign, you know, and you could see, and you could watch this baby's eyes hearing those words, and you could see her saying, yeah, uh-huh. You know, and I thought, well, here we go. There's another, you know, wild evangelical, you know, so. But it astounds me that there's absolute unbridled joy with a capital J between those two little girls, and we all got to experience it, and in 30 seconds, it turned into something to be repressed. Wow. That just made me so sad.
Should we stretch? Please.